Today on Movie World, as we continue our coverage from Tribeca Film Festival 2017. Time for Movie Rollers. Hi, this is Joe.
Hi, it's Rashmi.
And Yazdi as well.
Movie Rollers is your daily dose of film reviews, movie news, and general banter from the Tribeca Film Festival 2017. Tripped over my words again there because it's after midnight now on our third day of covering Tribeca. And what's the total tally here?
27.
It's going to be another 9 movies again today, isn't it?
Correct.
So we're not keeping true to our promise of not gorging ourselves on movies.
But we're trying not to.
I think it's generally relaxed. I wouldn't say in the mornings it's a bit rushed with back to back movies, but I think as the day wears on, it's quite relaxed.
Correct.
Yeah, no, this is true. It's not like we haven't done anything else. We had some fine food again today.
Yes.
Rashmi and I popped over to Union Square, met with a friend of ours, which was nice. Yes,
I met with some friends who also came over to watch a screening. And we had dinner afterwards.
So it's part of the film festival holiday and experience. We encourage everyone listening to get your butt out of... Remember there was a TV show in the UK, which is why don't you get your butt off of the couch and...
Why don't you?
Yeah, why don't you sit up and get up off your butt and go out and do something less boring instead? And
yes.
I think that's exactly why people should go to film festivals.
Yeah, you can easily watch... I think 3-4 movies and still have time left over to be out and about the city.
Yeah. So, Joe, you met someone today who was a member of the public.
Yeah, no. So in fact, it was interesting because some of the public screenings overlap with the press and industry screenings. And I was waiting for the two of you, actually. My movie finished a little early. And I met this lady who was, been a long time member of Tribeca. She's actually going to see 22 movies in the film festival and
giving us a run for our money.
Indeed, yeah. She was kind of lamenting about something I've been lamenting over, which is the voting system this year.
I think it's
been made somewhat complicated. So just so everyone knows, the traditional way of voting at film festivals was they would give you a slip of paper as you exited the movie.
And pre-printed.
Pre-printed, and you could tear your score. And then they would hand tally it afterwards. And they've gone modern. They've gone, probably environmentally friendly by putting it all into an app. And the problem is the app, in order to prevent fraud, is locked down via GPS and time window. So you're only able to vote within 60 minutes, I think, of the movie ending and in proximity to the theatre. So if you hustle out of the theatre pretty quickly and you've forgotten to vote via the app, then you can't do that. And I guess it's no different to the way it used to be, except there was something...
Well, the way it used to be is they would hand you those slips of paper, and then as you were exiting, they were waiting with boxes. So it kind of reminded you, and it takes you literally half a second to tear your score on that piece of paper. Now you have to go into the app, look for the movie, find the right place, and then vote for it.
Yeah.
And I don't know. I mean, I know that doesn't take too long, but it requires your active engagement without somebody reminding you.
And a certain amount of tech savvy, because I think the lady I was speaking to today, I don't like to guess people's ages because they're usually terribly wrong, but she was well up there and not particularly savvy with her cell phone. She admitted that. And so the whole voting process for her was actually a little cumbersome and tricky. So, it's not a perfect system. I hope they work to improve that in some way. Even if they had like iPad voting booths on the way out where you could just tap your score and they could perhaps manage fraud by, just by the exit process. You can't go back and keep voting.
Yeah, and I think this would be prone to a bias in that, only those people who are technologically savvy as well as those people who are a little bit more organized, are going to go in and bother to vote, whereas... Previously, they would get an assured response from 70-80% of the audience. Now it's probably going to be down to 5-10%, I would think.
Yeah.
So I think they might be rethinking that next year. I'm willing to bet.
I hope so.
Yeah.
I hope so. Because the other thing is, if you're hightailing it out of one film and running to the other one, you can't vote for both because it'll be within the time frame.
Yeah. So I'm giving them permission to change.
Yeah, I agree.
Yes. Yeah.
And speaking of permission.
Yes. Oh, I like that segue, Yazdi.
So, speaking of permission, indeed, that was the first movie of the day for all of us. This is a movie that's been entered into the Spotlight Narrative Competition. It's a USA movie directed by Brian Crano, And the movie stars Rebecca Hall, Dan Stevens, Gina Gershon. I'm going to read straight from the book here because it is after midnight. My brain's not particularly able to summarize the description. So as far as Anna is concerned, she couldn't be happier with her boyfriend, Will. They're talking about marriage and hoping to close on a new Brooklyn brownstone together. While out for dinner with her on her birthday, Anna's brother and his partner innocently point out that she's never been with anyone other than Will. It doesn't take long for that seemingly innocuous observation to alter Anna and Will's future. So, guys, what did you think of Permission?
So, I'll just say it. I love this movie. And this is the kind of movie I like. It's very polished. It's very mainstream. And it deals with a topic that has been dealt by many other movies before, which is, you know, a couple deciding mutually that, you know, they're going to try and open their relationships and try other partners before they decide if they're right for each other. And what I liked about the movie is that these actors are absolutely terrific. Rebecca Hall and Dan Stevens are really good. The writing is very good. It's genuinely funny in parts. It's insightful. But setting all those usual things aside, I think what I really liked about the movie is it kind of lulls you into thinking that it's your standard mainstream romantic Hollywood rom-com, and then it pulls a fast one on you, I think. So I really liked how it kind of always bested my expectations.
Rashmi?
Oh, this one made me feel sick to my stomach because really? This is the ultimate can of worms with right. huge worms coming out of a, you yeah. know, can that should never be opened. So in that sense, it's somewhat predictable, but I like how this was done. I like that this covers, you know, I really like that we got to see a heterosexual couple and a homosexual couple. Right. And it was equally indiscriminate of right. how both those relationships go. And I think the thing it did really well was look at the difference between just a physical sexual relationship and the power of relationship. And the thing that impressed me the most about this movie was the acting.
Yeah.
This was amazing acting by everyone. But the one that really caught my eye was Dan Stevens.
Really?
I mean, because look, recently we've seen, he's famous for Downton Abbey.
Mm-hmm.
We saw him as the Beast in Beauty and the Beast recently. And now here he is doing a flawless American accent for me.
Yeah. And I think this is, you know, in terms of the premise itself, I think it's a bit of a hard sell.
Correct.
Because most people will say, don't go that way, right? Correct. Like you said, you know, why even go that way?
Yeah.
But I think when you have, you know, a B script and you put A+ actors, you land up with an A- movie, which is what this is. This is a very good movie, which is elevated by these actors. And Rebecca Hall, you know, when is her ship going to come in? I mean, she's been consistently doing fine work. She almost reminded me of a very young Emma Thompson in this movie, something about her sensibility. There's something very warm and genuine and authentic in everything she does. And here she has a difficult role and she doesn't miss a beat. She just makes it all stick.
Yeah, you know, I mean, I thought this was... This started out for me as kind of one of those very run-of-the-mill 30-something dilemma comedies, you know. The kind of thing, the kind of setup that we've seen 1,000 times. You said it before, Yazdi.
Mm-hmm.
But... You know, it had some very sharply written dialogue, and you know, it got predictably complex from an emotional perspective, as these types of situations can end up. And like you yesterday, I think the thing that I liked about it was it stayed ahead of me. Mm-hmm. You know, there was I think the ending was pretty much note perfect, which mm-hmm. is very difficult to do yes. in this kind of situation. You know, it almost felt like they wrote themselves into a corner, and then they get it in a way that is not dissatisfying to the audience, but is also not cliche.
And it's wistful, and it's world weary and mature.
Yes,
and it's not your, you know, dreamy.
Well, we know, let's not.
Yeah, but you know, there's a maturity about the script.
Spoiler territory.
It didn't
here.
Feel disposable,
but it was, I mean, right. it was intelligent. It kind of left me with a. You know, it felt as if that's perhaps the way things might have gone.
Yeah,
it's handled very well, and at the same time, it's kind of a cautionary tale too about be careful about what you ask for, because you know you may not be ready to handle what you get. You know, so for me, it was that part actually came through really well for me.
Yeah.
You know, with the best of intentions. And I really liked, there's another character in the movie that Rebecca Hall first meets, you know, and I really liked her interaction with that particular person. Like you said, I like that the gay character is played just as, you know, matter-of-factly as the other couple. And Jason Sudeikis in a takes a really small role, but just he's right
Jason
for it.
Jason Bateman.
Sudeikis.
Yeah, I was getting the two mixed up.
It's perfect. I don't know.
Yeah, and it's interesting because Dan Stevens reads very similar to Jason Sudeikis in this movie, mm-hmm. in terms of
sensibility.
So I was like, I wonder if Jason Sudeikis read for the lead character.
Right, right.
But ended up getting this other character because they wanted to keep him in the movie. Interestingly, Morgan, Michael Spector, who plays Reese, the one of the gay characters of the gay couple, is actually married to Rebecca Hall.
Oh, the brother or the brother's partner?
The brother's partner.
Oh, okay.
Interesting little bit of gossip tidbit.
Yes, a bit of trivia.
That's pretty good. The other thing, did you guys notice, I've never quite, maybe Nocturnal Animals was the closest that I saw this device being used. And I almost didn't pick it up initially, but it kind of was working through the whole movie where in one scene, you know, the two of them are sitting, they're sitting at a restaurant and somebody says something earth-shattering. And in the background, somebody drops a whole, you know, whole bunch of glasses.
Yes.
And it kind of, the external action kind of actualizes what those characters are feeling.
Yes.
In another scene, Dan Stevens is walking back and he's really, really upset. And he walks by a car, you know, whose engine is on fire. And it kind of, again, reflects how he's feeling at that time. And there's a lot of that. And that kind of stuff can come off really bad. You know, it can come off looking very amateurish. But here It works.
It's not in your face. I think if it had been
right.
a shot of the car on fire, I think it would have been. But it ended up feeling very background and subliminal in some way. Same with the So yeah, that was kind of a nice touch, and I think it kind of elevated it above the. You know, Noah Baumbach kept coming to mind as I thought about this movie, and perhaps it was just a New York setting because it's very much a New York movie, but. Those little details kind of lifted it up a little bit.
Yeah,
for me.
And I think there's an honesty about it that stopped it from being precious.
Yeah,
this one could have easily got very precious, and it just shied away from that for me. So brilliant movie, really
great
enjoyed
film.
This.
And I'm just going to end by saying thank God for Gina Gershon. I mean, for me, she stole the movie amongst a lot
she's
of very good
funny.
Actors, and she's hilarious here. I don't know. All her last scenes were just brilliant. I thought she was great in it.
Yeah.
She's just amazing. So definitely check out Permission, guys.
Okay. Indeed. Next is Tilt. So Yaz, you saw this one. This is an unemployed documentary filmmaker's behavior becomes increasingly erratic in the months after his wife becomes pregnant. And this is written and directed by Kasra Farahani. And also written by Jason O'Leary and stars Joseph Cross, Jesse Hodges, Billy Curry, and many others. So you were the only one that saw this, Yazdi. What do you think?
Yeah, so this film is programmed under the midnight section at Tribeca, and usually...
What? You went to see a horror?
Yeah, and usually I'd already sat down in it before I realized that this is a horror movie. But it's interesting because... It's a horror, but it doesn't play by the general rules of horror in terms there are no like...
Don't go down there.
Yeah, don't go down there. There are no quick jumps. And all it is it's a very... It's a small film made with relatively unknown actors. But it's about... It's very difficult to... Because there are spoilers here, but it's about the systematic... mental breakdown of an individual.
Right.
How a person, you know, you hear all the time in the news about somebody who was a serial killer. And then they, you know, the neighbors will say, but he was the sweetest person and we've known them for 15 years. And
well,
how does that sweetest person become a serial killer? And, you know, it kind of very beautifully documents how a person might, you know, go from being, you know, from Jekyll to Hyde.
Right.
In a very naturalistic way. And it's because it plays his actions as very banal and there's no screeching music and there's no quick cuts. it's when commonplace people do evil things that it really kind of shocks you. So it's pretty, it's a very effective movie. It's not horror at all, but I think it's more a character study in a mental breakdown. So I liked it.
Okay.
Yeah.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Joe, then you went to watch The Last Animals, which is a documentary.
Yes, so The Last Animals is a feature documentary by photojournalist Kate Brooks, who turns her lens from war zones to a new kind of genocide in this sweeping and sobering film. I'm reading from the notes from Tribeca here. As the single-digit population of the northern white rhino ticks closer to extinction, Brooks exposes the epidemic of highly effective poachers and trafficking syndicates and the heroic efforts of conservationists, park rangers, and scientists to protect these majestic creatures. So this American documentary is playing in their competitive feature documentary category. Joe, you were the only one who saw it, so tell us about it.
Yeah, I mean, this is a very powerful piece of filmmaking here. You know, documentaries serve many purposes at film festivals, but the thing that they do most effectively for me is kind of open my eyes to you know, activities that just kind of go on around you that you just don't, you know, you may hear the odd snippet here and there in the news, but, you know, you don't understand the extent and the damage and the danger of where we're heading. So this particular documentary focuses heavily on a couple of different animal species, primarily rhinoceroses and elephants, both of which are hunted down for their ivory. And the ivory trade has been banned, although one of the things that the movie, you know, very clearly highlights is that, you know, there isn't a complete ban on ivory trade. It is still legal in many countries, including the United States, to buy and sell ivory. There's no federal ban, for example. There has been an international ban on, you know, the ivory trade, but it's still okay to, you know, buy and sell things that were previously made of ivory, which creates a bit of a loophole. And it's also okay to, a couple of countries have had like one-time amnesties on ivory that's been recovered from poachers to have sale. So what I think the movie does very effectively is, you know, number one, it shows us, you know, there's species of rhino that there are down to single digits. There is a northern white rhino, which at the start of filmmaking had like five or six animals. Over the course of the movie, you know, two of them died, so there are now three of them left in the world with almost no hope of recovering the species.
Really?
Other than through eggs and sperm. So it's the northern white rhino. There are still other types of white rhino that are in existence, but this one is down to three known, and they're all in captivity. The other thing the movie does is kind of focuses on two specific groups of people. One is a conservationist who tries to tackle the poaching trade route by literally taking the DNA of the animals from the conservation areas, and then if a piece of ivory is you know, located in some sort of hall, he will try and match that, and through that he's been trying to map the roots of the ivory. So he's figured out a lot of different ways where ivory is kind of shipped and transported. So
that's very
he's done a very good job there.
I didn't know
that
there was DNA in ivory.
Yeah,
but
he pioneered a technique where you can take a small square of the ivory and then obtain just enough DNA to uniquely identify the animal, and through that he's been following along. And then also just a group of counter-poacher game preserve people, again, some of whom died in the movie. I think overall it's just a very powerful moving documentary. It makes you question, what are we doing to the planet? Why are we doing this to animals? You know, the nonsense of the ivory trade, because, you know, it's taken mainly to countries where they believe it has medicinal powers and properties, and we all know that that's nonsense. It's essentially keratin. So both the animal population of elephants and rhinoceroses are suffering. I would say, you know, the only one thing that I would say that the documentary missed a little, if you were to ask me, you know, where it could be improved, I think is it doesn't really get into what drives the poachers. There's the poach trade, which is led by these very powerful people, but the individual people who go out there to kill these animals and recover a great risk to themselves. Many of them die in the attempts.
I mean, I wonder if anyone's even willing to speak on camera for fear of being,
well, you know, I mean,
marched,
you know,
to the local jail.
Correct. I mean, but the issue for me is obviously it's poverty. Why does anyone get into that kind of risk? risky business. It's because they can earn, you know, a few dollars for selling these things that are then sold on to other people at much higher value. So, but it's very, very powerful. I recommend anyone see this, and really it felt like a call to action, which I feel motivated to act in the way that many of the best documentaries do.
So listen to a future show to see what Joe did.
Last Animals.
Then literally right before Aaron, which doesn't sound like a weird sentence, does it? It's a really strange name for a movie. So yes, you're the one that's only one that saw that.
And I'll get a very, very brief introduction again. I'm looking at the Tribeca Film Guide here, but this one caught my attention because it has the, you know, they're somewhat typecast Justin Long in it. So, you know, as I was looking at the description here, this is a movie, again, part of the Spotlight US Narrative Competition here at the Film Festival, directed by Ryan Eggold, who has a number of TV credits to his name. I believe this may be a feature debut for him. But it also stars Justin Long, Kobe Smulders, Ryan Hansen, John Cho, Louis Guzman, and a few others. So the basic premise here is, still reeling from his breakup with college sweetheart Allison, Adam is devastated when she announces her plan to marry a man that she's known for only a year. What's worse is that Adam is invited to the wedding. Yazdi, tell us about literally right before Aaron.
Because this sounds a little bit like that Matthew McConaughey movie.
Oh, yeah, The Wedding. I know what you mean. Yeah, I know what you mean. I can't remember the name.
The one with Jennifer Garner. See if I can. Yeah. Correct. Okay, go ahead.
So again, here is another movie which is singularly elevated by really good performances, and particularly Justin Long is very good here. I mean, I wouldn't have thought so, because he tends to be, at least his early work is all pretty similar in terms of his affect and his sensibility. Yes. But he's become pretty versatile. I was telling Rashmi, just a few months ago, I saw him live theater in San Diego at Babu Aplak in a Steve Martin play, playing, you know, Einstein of all things. And now here he is in this movie, which calls for him to do a lot of, you know, it's actually pretty much the whole movie is Justin Long. I mean, he's in every single scene. And so he makes it work. He makes it all work. But I guess my only, if I had to pick a bone with the movie, it is that it doesn't have anything else up its sleeve beyond the central premise, which is what you described, that this guy who was deeply, deeply in love with this girl, you know, a year after separation, finds out that she's getting married to someone else, and she invites him to the wedding, and he just cannot deal with that. And we saw that kind of in, Bridesmaids, and, you know, we saw in other movies, and I wish the movie had something else, something more, you know, something more about the pathology of why they broke up, or, you know, what made them. So it's very, very inspired by something like 500 Days of Summer, which also dissects, you know, what happened, you know, to a relationship which has gone bad. Kobe Smulders is good, and it has really a smattering of very good, like, character actors. Dana Delaney is here, Peter Gallagher, Louis Guzman, Leah Thompson, John Cho. Wow. They're all here. It's pretty good. For me, it kind of felt just a little bit short, because I would have wanted a movie like this to kind of say something more in its plot other than somebody just pining for their, you know, lost ex, which is pretty much the sum of the movie. And then I think a little bit of a misstep towards the end, where it tries to do this homage to The Graduate, the movie Graduate, and the way it ends. And I, you know, I don't know if anybody will get it, but it just seemed a little bit forced to me. But it's a, you know, not a bad way at all to spend 2 hours with these actors, with Justin Long and with Kobe Smulders. Kobe Smulders is just lovely.
Yeah, I really have a problem with the title. I mean, I hope that when it goes for a main release, they do something about the title, maybe.
Yeah, and literally it's a piece of dialogue where somebody says, you know, hey, Adam, you know, how soon was it when you and whatever the female character, you know, used to date? And he says, oh, you know, last September. And then he says, oh, so literally right before Aaron. You know, Aaron is the guy she's getting married to. But that's not reason to make that the title of the movie, because it doesn't slip off your tongue very easily.
Yeah, it's hard to remember.
Yeah, literally right before Aaron. But anyway, it's okay. It's a fun movie.
Okay. So then, Joe, you did The River Below. And this is another conservation-esque type documentary. Clearly, you were a little disturbed after permission and decided to fill your afternoon with documentaries. So A River Below captures the Amazon in all its complexity as it examines the actions of environmental activists using the media in an age where truth is a relative term.
Yeah, so this is a fascinating documentary. It starts off very conventionally by, taking us along with a conservationist who has been looking at these near mythical animals called the pink river dolphin that's indigenous to part of the Amazon River, and they're a dolphin as one would expect, but they live and they interact very much with humans. They're very special animals, but they've become increasingly endangered due to many of the environmental issues, and their numbers have been dropping over time. Recently, their numbers have started to crash, and it turns out that a particular type of fish called the piracatinga, which is popular in Colombia.
Sounds like a good dish.
That's the problem. It's considered to be a very tasty fish, and it became a popular food in Colombia. For various reasons, because they essentially overfished their local stocks of a fish that was very similar. And it happens to be kind of a bottom feeder type fish. And one of the tragedies of for the dolphin is that one of the best ways to catch a heavy load of piracatingas is to murder a dolphin and then use the flesh of the dolphin as bait, because it attracts these scavenger fish.
God, that's horrible.
Exactly. And so this is what's been happening. These dolphins that are already rare are now being slaughtered.
In Colombia.
In Brazil. On the Amazon. And then the flesh is being used in the river, which attracts these piracatinga fish. And so obviously people who depend on the piracatinga for their livelihood have been catching enormous numbers of them using slaughtered dolphin. This didn't get any media attention in Brazil until their equivalent of Steve Irwin, the crocodile hunter in Brazil, drew attention to the matter. And he did it anonymously, but this is partly why this documentary becomes such a fascinating look at the power of television, because he was able to draw attention to this by effectively using his celebrity to go into the Amazon to speak to the people who fish this fish, videotaping them slaughtering one of these dolphins and then allowing that footage to be displayed on the news. It created an outrage, it changed the law, and it's essentially solved one of the problems that they have with the conservation of this particular animal. But it's like, when do you go too far as a conservationist? Because the real conservationist said, this isn't the way you go about making change, right? You don't go out and effectively have an animal slaughtered specifically for capturing the footage. Nobody, this is a very secretive trade.
Yeah, but it was happening anyways, right?
It was, but this is the kind of the moral territory that the documentary tries to kind of get into. The guy himself is, very much a celebrity character. He feels very strongly that he did the right thing. So it was one of those things where you kind of wonder, is it the right thing to do to specifically go out there and essentially pay for the slaughter of one of these animals on camera in order to change public opinion? The consequences were effective and he achieved that, but there's certainly a moral question there. The movie then tries to be very balanced and also shows the effect that the banning of these this fishing had on the local communities, because they were dependent on this particular type of fish for their trade. So terrific documentary. It looks at personalities, it looks at conservation, it looks at the messy truth of it all. There's no real right answer to a lot of the issues there, and it's just a fascinating look at this particular problem that Brazil and Colombia have been dealing with. So,
and was this as much a call to arms as The Last Animals? Because I'm reading a text that Joe sent to both Yazdi and I straight after, which said, finish The Last Animals, wipe the tears from my eyes, and I'm heading to a river below. So it's a brave decision.
I actually think this is a better movie in the sense of I think it has a lot more to the story. It presents more of a balanced picture. It isn't necessarily about conservation in and of itself, although that is a part of it. It's about, you know, what we are as a society, the power of television to get the law changed, and then the power of the unintended consequences. I mean, you know, yes, you save a river, but now you've jeopardized a human community, and there's a lot of economic forces at play. It touches on some of the things that I wish The Other One had, which is, you know, these people aren't going out there to try and make this dolphin extinct. This is their livelihood. Right. This is the way that they try and, you know, make a living for themselves and educate, feed, clothe their families. So very, very morally ambiguous Corny stuff. Issues, but it's a fascinating documentary. I recommend that everyone see this because it unfolds beautifully and really lets you make your own judgments about what's happening here.
OK, so while you were watching Rivers, I was in House of Zed. Or House of Z?
So House of Z is an American documentary directed by Sandy Chronopoulos, and it pretty much covers Zac Posen, the fashion designer, who rocketed to fashion stardom at a pretty young age with his unique design aesthetic and charismatic presence, becoming one of the most recognizable faces in the business today. But like any journey to great success, it hasn't come without cost. Sandy Chronopoulos' film looks past the glamour of the red carpet and the runway to shine a light on the trials and tribulations of running one of the country's most successful fashion houses. So says the Tribeca Notes. So, Rashmi, you saw this. Tell us.
Yeah, so I love anything about fashion. I'm not necessarily fashionable, but I'm very interested in fashion and cloth making and just the whole kind of like in Shadow Man yesterday, how fashion fits into this kind of elitist, you know, it becomes part of elite communities in some ways and sorts of, you know.
The haves versus the have not.
Correct, yeah, correct. Yeah. Okay, so this is an amazing story because, for one, it taught me or certainly showed me that creative geniuses are born, not made. Clearly, Zac Posen is a highly talented designer from practically birth, you know, and this is in his blood. At its core, it's a film about families and what families do and the sacrifices they make. That's the core that kind of holds this movie together. But the most, I think, dramatic arc of the movie is the fact that it's a rags to riches or literally garbage bags to feathers in tool type film. Mm-hmm. And I use those analogies because that's what he designed with. He designed with garbage bags to start with. And then literally everything became so excessive that he was putting feathers in tool as part of accessories on dresses. So it's interesting then to see that for someone so young, and it states it in the movie that the fashion industry wanted him to fail, and fail he does, and he fails big time. So it's also like a rise from the ashes.
A rise and fall.
Yeah, a rise from fall. So it touched me in a way that I was more emotional watching this documentary than watching Permission or The Lovers, which is the one I saw after Permission, which were both relationship movies. Yet this movie kind of got under my skin and made me sob. Like I actually found myself sobbing in the documentary because it's so heartfelt. And then I actually read the press notes. What's interesting is that Sandy Chronopoulos, who's the director, didn't actually set out to make this movie. She was actually just going to make a one-hour TV special about Zac Posen. And when she started speaking to him, she was so enamored by how articulate he was, because he kind of became almost like a caricature of himself. And some nasty, you know, newspapers actually started calling him Zoolander. He was almost like the caricature of Zoolander. He had become that type of person. She didn't really set out to make this film, but I think that when she spoke with him, and it was actually when she spoke to his sister, that she realized there was way more to this story. So I think it's this, not only like this rise and fall, family, and then really it's about his genius. Wonderful documentary. If you have any interest in just understanding how geniuses work, or the fashion industry, or anything to do with New York, this is a brilliant documentary. Really enjoyed this.
Okay.
Sounds terrific. Let's move on to the other movie that I think you saw on your own.
Yes, which is The Lovers.
The Lovers.
So having been punished and having my stomach, like, you know, feeling like I was kicked, because I don't like terrible relationship stories, I decided I would go and watch The Lovers.
Just very briefly, looking at the...
I really wanted to watch this, by the way. I love Deborah Winger.
I think it's going to get a main release.
Yeah, I think she's a goddess that cinema has forgotten. But anyway...
This is another movie from the Tribeca Spotlight Narrative USA entry, directed by Azazel Jacobs, and also written by Azazel Jacobs. The movie stars Deborah Winger, Tracy Lett, Aidan Gillen, Melora Walters, Tyler Ross, and Jessica Sula. And this one was one that I was initially interested in, but having felt kind of emotionally kicked around by the first movie of the day that we had, which was Permission, I decided to go off in a different direction, which is how I headed down documentary path. But the basic premise here is described as: many years into their dispassionate marriage, a long married couple, both seriously involved with other people, have settled into an independent yet friendly arrangement. But pressure is mounting on from their respective partners to fully commit. So Mary and Michael resolve to call it quits.
Yeah, depressing thought, right? So this movie starts with the line, "Please stop crying, Lucy." Okay. But anyway, I think at its core, this is about a couple, or really it's about the situation when your affair almost becomes harder work than your marriage. Mm. So there's some comedic aspect to this, but it quickly turns in internality. Yeah. Because I think that it's also about the fact that affairs are hard work.
Mm.
They take, you know, sculling around in the dark and sort of figuring out a way to see this
other person.
Yeah, the other person. And then I think it becomes about how you feel if you're about to lose something.
Yeah.
And really the commitment that you made that's called marriage. So it kind of covers all of that. But I think if I was to sum it up, I mean, Deborah Winger is phenomenal in this movie. I think she's definitely outright the star of this movie and gives a brilliant performance. But really, if I was to sum it up, I think this is about the suburban decay of life and marriage.
Hmm. Because I think usually movies about people having affairs are about fairly younger people.
Correct.
And I think this looks at two characters who are of a certain age, right?
Yeah, and I think it's about, you know, I mean, if you think about, maybe this is appealing to baby boomers, who are now at the age where their children have left home, and then they're of a certain generation where the expectations of them were different to the expectations that are upon us.
High school sweethearts, yeah, very young age.
Yeah, and they had traditional roles, and yet the world's changed around them, right? So those traditional roles of man and wife no longer really exist. And so what do you have in common once the reason you were together or the thing that kept you together leaves?
Now, it's kind of billed as a comedy. Is it a comedy or like... Because it sounds like it was very dark.
Yeah, it has comedic moments, and those comedic moments are very funny. And I think Deborah Winger is very, very charming. But I would say it's more of a black comedy.
Okay.
More of a dramedy.
I look forward to watching it.
Yeah, I can't say I loved it. Mm. It's definitely not my favorite movie of today. Or the festival, but I think it has a lot to offer.
Okay, The Lovers.
And then let's move on to movie number 8 of the day, which is Pilgrimage.
Right, and this is the one, Yazdi, you saw this. Mm-hmm. And I'm going to do the intro, if my iPad ever recognizes my thumb. Things that we do to try and make things easier. I know. Okay, Pilgrimage. In the 13th century... In 13th century Ireland, a group of monks must escort a sacred relic across an Irish landscape fraught with peril. So this is directed by Brendan Muldowney, written by Jamie Hannigan, and it stars a whole host of people, including Richard Armitage, Tom Holland, and John Bernthal.
This looked excellent, by the way.
And it has a character called the Mute and the Herbalist.
Yes.
And Lopsided.
Yes.
Very interesting. I'm intrigued.
No, this actually looked very, very interesting to me. So you know, I'm kind of bummed we didn't get a chance to see this. But yes, Dee, what did we miss?
So I think, and I don't say this lightly, but this is a majestic movie which is so bruising and so brutal. And without saying much, it'll kind of, you know, bring to the surface whatever your thoughts might be about religion. So it's set entirely in the 13th century, and it's based on, I believe there's some historical merit to this, that there was a relic which the Roman Catholic Church wanted. It was associated with, you know, a miracle which happened. And you know, this relic, and I won't spoil it, but there's a relic which is covered in this gold case, which needs to be transported from Ireland back to Rome. And these monks decide to do this arduous journey, you know, across mountains and rivers. And it's epic and it's beautiful. And you'd really need to watch it on as big of a screen as possible. I saw it at probably the best cinema there is at the Regal Battery Park. It's a huge cinema, and I saw it on a huge screen. And it's the kind of thing which may get completely lost if you try to watch it on a small screen. It might try your patience, but it has these, you know, six or seven monks in it. And one of them, the youngest monk, who is kind of the conscience of the movie, is played by Tom Holland, who is getting a lot of popularity. He's going to be the new Spider-Man. But it makes you realize how, even in the 13th century, and I don't think the movie's taking too many liberties, how religion was justified, you know, to allow the most violent, horrible things to happen. So that for the church, that relic was so important that it justified killing people and tribes and so forth. And it's just so unwatchably violent. And, you know, it's almost mythical that, you know, these people on a quest. It reminded me so many times of Lord of the Rings, you know, in terms of this quest that a group of people have gone, these underachievers have gone on this quest, kind of like, you know, Lord of the Rings. And it's beautifully shot. And, you know, there are these five monks, and then there is another person who helps the monks along, and he's mute. He can't speak. And he's played by John Bernthal, who is absolutely wonderful. Yeah, he was there after the screening, and he answered questions along with the director. But if you remember, yesterday I mentioned John Bernthal was the lead actor in my favorite movie from yesterday, which was Sweet Virginia. So it's so great to see an actor suddenly emerge out of nowhere and just knock it out of the park. I mean, I think if you have a heart and you know, which is beating, there is no way you can watch this movie and not be very, very moved by it. It starts off a little bit slowly, but once their journey kicks in, it's just brutal and relentless.
And Yasti, is it kind of fantastical?
No.
Okay, so it's grounded in reality. It's
very much grounded in reality. I think necessarily so, because it tells a story in the 13th century.
But is it based on a historical fact?
I believe so.
Or set of facts? I mean, obviously, they have to use artistic license.
Correct.
Because there are no real records from many of those things. But
correct.
So it's based on something that actually occurred.
Correct. And, you know, there's this group of knights who form this very tenuous relationship with the monks to help carry that relic. But, of course, those knights have their own agenda. It just, you know, even if you have no religious beliefs, just as an action movie, it plays beautifully. It reminded me of something like The Mission. Do you remember that movie from, gosh, the 80s?
Sean Connery. With
Jeremy Irons, I think.
Oh, that's right, Jeremy Irons, that's
But just a magnificent film, really, visually and otherwise. A remarkable achievement. I love this movie.
Superb.
Yes.
Hopefully it will get a full release. I mean, it sounds like the kind of thing that that would. I mean, with that kind of scope and presumably a substantial budget behind it.
Yeah. And yeah. Great ending. Really not perfect ending.
Yeah. Yeah. I was just like looking up like, you know, relic-y, knight-y monkey movies. And I was thinking like Assassin's Creed, which was like the 15th century. And then obviously, you know, Martin Scorsese's Silence, which was about, you know, set in, about monks in the 17th century. So I think maybe there's this revival of
there's certainly an interest.
Monks now and religion and interesting.
Gorgeous
final film. Movie of the evening then is Rock and Roll.
Yeah, so real life couple Guillaume Canet and Marion Cotillard have been married for a long time, and they made a lovely movie which is on Netflix, by the way, called White Little Lies or Little White Lies. And if people are looking for something to watch, it's a cute little movie about three couples who get together and secrets get revealed and all manner of fun happens. But here they are again, husband and wife, working on this movie, Rock and Roll, in which they play themselves in this satirical comedy about a couple dealing with aging in the limelight. So they play themselves in the movie. After Guillaume gets told by a co-star that he's just not that cool anymore, he goes to increasingly extreme lengths to prove her wrong, putting his happy domestic life to the test, which sounds like a pretty funny premise. It's a two-hour movie from France, directed by Canet. So,
Canet.
You're the most French amongst us.
Well, yeah.
Canet.
Which means not very.
Yes.
Where do I start with this one? This is extraordinarily funny comedy about essentially the crisis of aging that especially I think a man can go through. You know, there's there comes this identity where, you know, you could reach a certain age and reflect on some of the decisions that you make in terms of, and this is somebody who's in the spotlight, so you know, clearly he's looking back on his life and he's turned into essentially an ordinary guy, which he hates. He wants to be the cool kind of rock star guy. And so obviously hilarity ensues. But what I loved about this movie was its brutal honesty about many, many facts of kind of getting older. I think it does come somewhat from the male perspective. I'm not sure if females can relate quite as much to the crisis of character that the main protagonist here is. But I think what makes it unique more than anything else is that this is a movie that Hollywood would never make. It turns the camera on celebrity and the bizarreness of being in the public eye and the pressures that are on actors to be, to look a certain way, to be forever youthful, about the things that happen in Hollywood with respect to people getting to a certain age and then not being cast in certain roles, and how hard that is personally on the people involved. So it kind of it pokes a really very strong satirical eye at the bizarreness of celebrity and show business and what it can do to people. And I love the fact that these people played themselves. They were not
they have the same names. Marion Cotillard is Marion.
Absolutely, okay. Yeah. They and I think it's very much a look on their life with a huge sense of humor. So before I go any further, I'll let Rashmi have a shout in here, because I could talk about this for hours.
Yeah, I was going to say, yes, the hands down, the funniest and the best movie of Tribeca so far.
Really?
Hands down. I mean, this is incredibly funny. I haven't laughed this hard in a movie. Since Bridesmaids. Mm. I mean, it's absolutely hilarious. The comic timing is genius. The dialogue is so witty. And, you know, I think we're going to start to see a slew of coming of age movies, a coming of middle age, right? Mm. I think that's the new onslaught of movies that we're going to get. Because I think aging in today's world is seen so negatively.
Mm.
And we're all trying to stop that. So I think it's a really funny look at men aging. And Joe, I know you say it's from the point of view of the man, but I think it's very easy for a woman to laugh at this because women have faced this problem for many years all along.
And so I think it's earlier.
Actually funnier that they've made the man in this coupling be the one who goes through the midlife crisis, but because he's aging, you know, it was a really good dissection of kind of that journey to what breaks someone and ultimately makes them do stupid things in an effort to hang on to youth, you know. Yeah, bravo, encore. Anything else I can think of?
Yeah.
Wonderful, wonderful movie. And what? And they bring it. Marianne Cotillard and Guillaume Canet, they are not afraid to poke fun at themselves. And it's a very meta movie, Yazzie. You would describe this as meta because it's almost looking in at itself and telling you what it's doing.
When they embarked upon this project, it's very clear that the two of them decided to check their egos at the door. And they do a number of things that show you how brave they are as a working couple in Hollywood, in you know, the French equivalent of Hollywood, in that, you know, they aren't afraid to poke fun at their own successes. They aren't afraid to poke fun at the difference between the way the two of them have been received and their career successes. They aren't afraid to poke fun at the, you know, Marianne Cotillard, I think, is known for being, you know, somewhat of a method actress. So, there's this hilarious joke in the movie where, you know, she decides that this comes very early on, so it's not a spoiler, but she decides that she gets a part playing a Canadian. And so she literally switches into this mode of speaking Canadian French and some of the bizarre words that kind of come
how they
that.
Translate, and there's so much
for
hilarity.
The first third of the movie, like, you literally can't understand what he doesn't know what she's talking about half the time, but you know, it does that. It pokes fun at her success in terms of number of awards that she's made relative to him, who has not been as successful from kind of an awards perspective. It's so brave and candid, and you know, it's just a remarkable that the two of them have clearly a depth of relationship where neither of them are insecure about the other's success in any which way.
And what's really interesting is that this has a ton of people in it who are all playing themselves.
The French film industry.
Correct. And they're all playing themselves.
And then as a final point, you know, just to kind of wrap up my thoughts on this, is that it, again, is one of these movies that writes itself into something of a corner and then just takes off.
Yeah.
I mean, it gets to a point where you're like, okay, where could this go now? And it then beyond commits. I mean, it takes it to a level that no one would have ever expected at the beginning. And it's not for pure kind of, you know, slapstick joke. It makes you really think about the message behind the movie. Like, what is it that we celebrate here? In Hollywood and celebrity and yeah, I've said enough. Go see this movie, given the smallest chance. It's absolutely worth your while to seek this one out.
Yeah, I agree. Hands down, like I said, hands down my favorite movie so far.
So clearly Rashmi has opined on her favorite movie of the day and of the whole festival. What was your favorite movie of the day, Joe?
You know, I'm going to struggle with this. I think the one that will stay with me the longest is probably A River Below.
Okay.
Just because of it's got so much meat to it from an intellectual perspective that I'm going to take a while to think it all through. And there's point and counterpoint and you know, so really, you know, that. And, you know, Rock and Roll was also terrific, but I'll stick with A River Below. How about you?
For me, I mean,
I want to try and guess Yazdi's.
It's a tie between Permission and Pilgrimage.
I was just going to say that.
The 2P movies, both are quite special in their own way. But I think if somebody put a gun to my head, definitely just the scope and the vision of Pilgrimage is remarkable. And again, I hope Permission gets released and it's successful. And I'm really very eager to see Rock and Roll as well as The Lovers. So we have our work cut out.
Yes.
So we march on into our last day, I think, not the last day of the Tribeca Film Festival, but our presence at Tribeca tomorrow. And we'll be doing our final catch-up podcast after that.
Yes, indeed. Yeah, we probably won't be able to catch quite as many movies tomorrow because we do have plans to move on from New York as we will. But yeah, it's been a superb festival so far, and we look forward to our final.
I can't believe we've seen 27 movies.
Yeah. I know, right? In 3 days, wow. It feels pretty intense. And this year somehow doesn't feel quite as overwhelming as it did last year. But we'll see how we do tomorrow.
Yeah. Damn day jobs.
I know, right?
Anyway.
So
that allow us to come to Tribeca Film Festival.
Yes. Thank you, day jobs. Yes. Yes. Allow us time to get away and spend our vacation watching movies like nobody's business.
Yes.
So do look out for our final podcast. I'll release it as soon as I can after this. And that will wrap up our coverage for 2017. The film festival itself runs until, I think, the end of the month here in New York. So if you're here and about, do check it out. And some of the movies that we've spoken about on the podcast will have screenings over the next week or so. So you haven't missed them if you're listening to this and wish that you could check one of them out.
You can.
All the way to April 30th, indeed. Yes.
All right, let's wrap up for tonight because it's sometime around 1 a.m. here in the morning, I think.
I'm already in bed.
This is probably a first here. Rashmi's actually podcasting from her bed. Not just on the bed, but in the bed, in the pajamas. Bed. So,
yes.
In the hotel room.
Be glad that this isn't one that we do. Oh, maybe not be glad. Maybe it's disappointing that you don't have video with Movie Wallace this time around.
Joe, this isn't rock and roll Movie Wallahs. I'm not going to break into Celine Dion.
Damn. All right, let's wrap it up for tonight, guys. Until tomorrow, too many movies and too little time. Never is that truer than at a film festival. A good night from me.
And me.
And me as well.